All right. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WG. And happy Friday. It looks like we're going to have a nice, balmy weekend ahead. As I told Bill and Wendy, we're going to talk about the business of comedy with Bert Haas coming up in the second half hour. And we're going to wrap up the show with a woman, I think she's from Iowa, who's written a book on Benjamin Franklin and the food he ate.
Oh, wow.
How does that sound? I'm not sure what the business angle is there, but I've got 45 minutes to figure that out.
Yeah, was there avocado toast?
There wasn't, but
yes,
actually,
or no.
He was involved in food policy early on, and it's the book says that he was a big proponent of locally grown food. And I'm thinking there probably wasn't a lot of shipping of food there then, although he had his apples shipped from the U.S. to France. So there, a lot to learn. That's the voice of Andrea Haynes, who is the editor of Blue Sky Innovation in the Chicago Tribune. Oh, we have so much to get to.
Yes.
Okay, so for Christmas, I had this bright idea of giving my parents and my son. My son's always like, what am I? Am I German? Am I Irish? So I got them a 23andMe spit kit. And I thought, well, if they're getting it for them, I'm going to get it for myself too, because there was a deal. And so I bought four of them. They have not got their results back. I got my results back. I was very excited about it at first, although it says I'm 99% Northwestern European.
Steve is white, everybody.
I am
a
white boy.
We now know.
My mom's maiden name is Gordon, and I had a Catholic writer named Gordon once who told me that's a Jewish name, predominantly. And so I was looking forward to being a little more Jewish. I'm 0.3% Middle Eastern or North African, so I don't know if that counts. I'm 46% British and Irish, which counts in my house. Although I wish, you know, if you're Irish, you don't want to be British.
You want to know which.
Yes, I wish they had broken that up. I bring all this up, though, just to say that there was an article you guys put up about how this stuff isn't so reliable. I love the fact that it can cause family strife.
Explain, I know, right? Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting. Also, with any kind of genealogy, right, you start to wonder, like, because people do have affairs, they do have children out of wedlock, and so it might not all follow the legal documents that you're finding,
so the
you know, where everything's official.
Maybe the milkman was 3% Middle
Eastern. The milkman might have played into it, exactly.
But you can't. This is candy, not science.
Yes. So there was a writer from Gizmodo who did what you did, but did it across multiple of these different options for doing the DNA testing, and just found really divergent results and some surprising results. So it was just kind of digging into, like, what exactly are they promising here? What exactly do they know? And the companies will tell you they need, you know, the more testing they do, the more they'll be able to refine the results, meaning that now they're not completely refined. And sometimes you'll get a more general region or that kind of thing versus necessarily being able to give you exact percentages of exact, you know, countries of origin or things like that.
Right. I got 19.7% was unidentified, but broadly Northwestern Europe. So, like, they couldn't specify Norway. There's Norway in there and things like that.
Yeah. So you wonder if over time there'll be a way that you can kind of continue to zero in on that,
so
as they perfect what they're doing.
I still think it was kind of worth it. I mean, I wish it was more specific, but it was kind of fun, and that's what it's about mostly, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what, you know, the critics will sort of say, just, like, take it for what it's worth, which is basically entertainment value. But don't start, you know, don't doubt that your father's your father if you get a result that's a little bit surprising. Like, you know, you can think of negative ways that people could kind of take it, or just ways that it could shock people,
right,
that maybe they don't need to be shocked.
If you show up 32% Bulgarian and your family lore is that you're from, you know, the Horn of Africa,
yeah,
someone's got some explaining to do.
Exactly.
All right, so there's that. Let's go to the grocery store. Another great story,
yes,
you guys had about how retail is changing. And I just love, you know, the part that stuck out to me was this idea of having a smart grocery cart that will take you to what you're looking for.
Love that idea, right?
I mean, I enjoy grocery shopping, so I enjoy wandering around, but I hate looking for the specific thing that, you know, my wife needs that I don't know where it is. And now I could type in, I could just punch in, what, creamed corn, and the shopping cart will take me to the creamed corn?
Yep, you get your list. So this is from the National Retail Federation, which met this week, and it was interesting because obviously we all think everybody's moving to online shopping, but there are actually a lot of innovations that impact you in the store. And what you're mentioning is one of them, which is a robotic shopping cart where you can actually import your shopping list, and it will actually guide you to the items that you're looking for in the store. So if you're one of those people like me, I tend to get, like, I have to look at every item in the store or I don't feel like I've done a good job.
You check the price
per
unit.
So this could perhaps help me, you know. Yeah, I just like to look at every, I don't know, it's some kind of shopper's disease. I don't know. I'm not very efficient. Like some people can go in and go peanut butter, bread, apples, and they're out the door.
Those people have no joy in their life.
Maybe that's it.
You want to compare.
But the cart can help you do that apparently because it will take you to the peanut butter, the bread, and the apples and get you out the door.
Another thing, and so this is future. Right.
This is future. But some of these things are, they're not necessarily like future 25 years from now. They're things that are coming.
And Kroger is working with
and in
these,
some cases in use.
These
yeah.
digital prices, and they're doing that now.
Yeah. Kroger is doing dynamic pricing, which we tend to hear about again with online shopping, with startups. You may notice it on Amazon where prices will fluctuate a little bit. Kroger is already getting into this where they can look at, you know, they didn't say that they're actually marking up things that are scarce yet. Like if right. you're down to two bottles of ketchup in the store, are you going to like mark those up? That might not pay off in the end if you anger your customers. But they would say, you know, if they have suddenly they have tons of cereal, they can like do some quicker dynamic pricing.
It strikes
because it
me,
used to take them days to announce sales.
I'm thinking of the, it was in Venezuela where the, you know, the grocery store, they would change the prices through the day because of inflation went so fast.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing. It just lets a big place like Kroger where it would take a day or two to kind of institute that.
I used to
do
work,
it quicker.
I used to work at an Eagle supermarket and I had the little price gun where you'd have to to the again go back to the cream corn, stamp it, and now they can just with a couple of buttons change the prices of everything in their store.
Yep, this and will zip you through it faster.
That is up and running now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's something to watch, especially if the prices are changing through the day. Before we go, Huffington Post, this is interesting because you know you used to see you'd get pitches of a quote-unquote Huffington Post columnist. Anyone could be a Huffington Post columnist. I mean, literally anyone could be, right?
Yeah, so they were kind of the innovators in the space of getting, you know, the open platform kind of thing. But it also did become a little bit meaningless as to, like, what does it mean if it's a Huffington Post article? You know, it kind of became that. And they have a newer editor who came from the New York Times.
I mean, literally, right? Anyone could submit and be posted on the Huffington Post and then say, I was published by the Huffington Post.
Yeah, very open platform.
Right.
Makes sense in certain ways, perhaps, certainly at the time. But now the new person in charge is kind of feeling like it's an era of fake news. We need to have tighter rein on like what, you know, what's being posted under our name, literally. Like, what are we putting out there? What are we kind of promulgating? So they shut down their contributors network and they're just going forward with some different ways of doing things.
So a little tighter there. All right. Andrea Haines, read more at
BlueSkyInnovation.com.
BlueSkyInnovation.com. What's up on Red Eye? Give me 5
Red Eye
seconds.
Has brunches for winter this week.
Nice.
So there is a guide to new brunches and sort of a delicious looking fried chicken biscuit going on the cover.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks very much, V. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Tom Gimbel is in the studio and he's glistening.
It's hot in here. I mean, I tell you, if you guys don't know what Steve looks like, he's usually very thin, but I would say in the past half hour, you've lost another 5-10 pounds of water.
So I don't want to make too much of it, but this happened a couple weeks ago. We're right about this time. The temperature and the, because, you know, they're working on the building, they're rehabbing
it. Yeah, right.
So the temperature started going up, and it was 89 when I finished my show. Kept going up through John's show. It hit 98 degrees in the studio. So
it's a good thing you both are thin guys and in shape and everything was okay.
I don't work well in heat. So can you just handle the rest of it?
I got it.
All right, turn that mic toward you. Tom Gimbel is your CEO of LaSalle Network. Well, I know you haven't been in here in a while.
I'm having withdrawals.
And LaSalle Network. And tell me a little bit about you guys and what you do, because we don't usually do that for
you. So we're a staffing and recruiting firm. So companies come to us and they ask us to help them fill their open positions. And we do it on a search basis, so permanent positions or temporary staffing. So I need somebody for a week, a month, a quarter, a year to come in and fill something.
Do would-be workers go to you too?
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
And we do it for human resources positions, administrative, accounting, finance, technology, supply, a bunch of different spots.
And you're just growing faster than the beanstalk.
We've got about 260 employees. We added about 110 people last year.
All right. So you looked at did a survey. You do this each year with your clients and sort of to forecast the future.
Yep.
How does it look this year?
It looks great.
Yeah?
I mean, over 50% of the companies, the contacts that we survey, because it's not an overall company, it's individual hiring managers, over 50% plan on hiring people.
Okay.
So.
What was it last year?
It was, I think, a little over, maybe 53 or 54%,
okay.
a little more. But I think, you know, it's who you're getting and when you're getting them and how they feel, but companies are hiring. We're going to see wages start to bump up a little bit at the end of the year. The economy is, I mean, that's the irony of what's going on right now. Unemployment's low. Companies are hiring. You can't find enough good people.
And yet the wages aren't going up to match that.
Well, and the problem with that is there's twofold. Number one, when baby boomers retire, you replace them with people out of college.
Okay.
So the salaries on salaried positions dip.
Okay.
Right?
So you tell me that explains the number?
No, that explains one part of
it. Okay,
okay. The second part of it is, as it really has become a global economy, that you're competing not against the guy in the cul-de-sac, you're competing against somebody in another country. And so you're not going to see wages increases if you can. And we're going to have that for the next 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, wages are where they're at. You've got it.
That's a big problem, though, Tom.
No. It's an economist-based Bureau of Labor Statistics statistic.
Okay.
So it takes everything. Waiters, waitresses, servers, radio hosts. It's not accurate. And it takes Omaha and New York and puts them in the same bucket.
So we shouldn't rely so much on that.
I mean, it's an important statistic because it's the same statistic we've been using all the time.
So it's a standard gauge.
It's a standard skewed number.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, that
right?
makes sense. Sure.
It's kind of like harness racing. If you don't know which horse is fixed, then are you really...
But if it's a standard skewed number, that it should still reflect some increases.
It should in a traditional economy, but you're going through something where, look at this, unions are much lower than they used to be,
right.
Which means hourly wages are going to fall, right? Baby boomers are retiring. Wages are going to fall, right? The only thing that'll happen, I think you'll start to see an increase at the end of this year when the municipality minimum wages that are increasing go in, when it goes from $8.75 to California, $11, $13, $15 an hour.
Right.
You'll start to see it go up.
All right, so then is it a workers' market now or is it not then? I mean, because...
I tell you, so that's a good question. It's how it used to be, right?
Right.
In high unemployment, it's an employer's market. Low unemployment, it's an employee market. This is so interesting because of the skills gap and because I've never seen such intrepidation in a great economy like there is right now.
It's weird, isn't it?
I don't see the companies afraid. They're hiring, right? But the employees, everyone's afraid to put money in the stock market. They think it's going to crash. Right, people are afraid to change jobs sometimes. I don't want to be the low man on the totem pole when it ends. I've never felt so confident, sans, you know, some global, you know, political thing, that this economy is going to be going this way for the next 2 years.
Tom Gimbel is the CEO of LaSalle Network. Follow them at LaSalleNetwork.com.
Yep, and on Twitter at LaSalle Network, and you can follow me for, 6 weeks until pitchers and catchers report.
All right, well, thanks for coming into the Schwitz. We'll hopefully do it again next week.
I'll go drink some water.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I'll tell you, I just flew in from Toledo, and man, are my arms tired. Come on. You are a charitable laugh if you laughed at that, Bert Haas.
I've heard a lot of jokes in my time, and that might be one of the worst.
Bert Haas is the manager at Zanies, the Zanies Clubs in Chicago, and out in Wheaton. Is there another?
St. Charles at the Pheasant Run Resort, and then our newest club is in Rosemont.
Right. I'm sorry, I screwed up the St. Charles one. Well, thanks for joining us today. I do appreciate
it.
Richard Lewis was around this week at the studio. It's great to see him. It's so much fun. And I'm reading, as you celebrate your 40th anniversary, I was just watching old videos of a woman I don't want to say I forgot about, but, I sort of misplaced her in my memory. Marcia Warfield is going to be playing at Zanies soon.
Yes, we're very excited. Marcia has basically come out of retirement to start her return tour at Zanies Comedy Club in Chicago as part of our 40-year. She's one of our stand-up comedy legends.
And, she probably hasn't been... When's the last time she would have performed at Zanies? It's probably in more than 20 years, right?
Oh, my gosh. It's almost probably 30 years ago now.
Yeah. So she will have to reintroduce herself to a whole new audience.
Well, I remember her distinctly, and I always thought that she was one of my favorite comedians. She could control a comedy club as well as anyone I've ever seen.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, just watching her characters and watching her act.
Yeah.
All right, so Bert Haas is on the phone, and I want to talk a little bit, not just about Zanies, but in general, the business of comedy and stand-up comics. Where are you today when it comes to popularity? I mean, it seems to me, Bert, I remember the mid to late 80s being this real heyday, and I don't know if you're back there or how things compare to the best of times.
Well, it's very popular right now because of all the opportunities to listen to via podcast, SiriusXM radio, et cetera, and also to watch stand-up comedy through the cable channels and Netflix, et cetera. And, of course, the whole online phenomena that is happening now as opposed to what was available 30 years ago, as an example.
It's interesting you brought that up because I was talking to Bill Leff before when he was wrapping up. I was going to ask you where people find their comedians now, because I'm not one of those guys who would seek out a stand-up comedian, but I was always exposed to them on The Tonight Show. I mean, that's where I learned about Seinfeld or David Brenner even, or, you know, people like that. They were presented to me, and it seems like now maybe people are going out to find them.
Yes, that's very true. The comedy community, the fans, are very active in seeking out comedians. And there's comedians that may not be that well known to the general public that have a strong niche following. And the result is that they can fill rooms and in some cases fill concert halls, even though if you ask the average person on the street, who is that, they would have no idea.
That's interesting because we've become so diffused in media. It's the same thing with YouTubers, right? I mean, my daughter will drive 150 miles to see a particular YouTuber who never heard of.
Yes, that's another phenomenon that has changed over the last 40 years.
So does that make managing a club easier or harder?
I think it's the same. It's always trying to present the best stand-up comedy that we can. And tastes change. It's interesting, even in styles that were appropriate, say, 25, 30 years ago, are now kind of looked upon as, oh, that's kind of old-fashioned, that particular style of comedy. But at the same time, language requirements have completely changed. An act that previously we might have thought, ooh, he's off color or she's a little dirty, would now basically be on television.
You know, that's I was at a business meeting yesterday, and I was surprised at the professional language that was being used. I think that's an excellent point. So are comedians knocking on your door, or are you knocking on comedians' doors to get them to your stage?
It's a combination. Of course, there's always aspiring comedians, and lots of them, more now than ever before. The hard part is to kind of separate the chaff from the wheat. And then, of course, those comedians that we particularly want, we've heard about them, or they're going to sell tickets, or they're just someone that we feel the public should be aware of, we're knocking on their door. We're actively seeking them.
How is the competition among clubs in the city? I mean, you know, when it comes to radio, you always want it to be a little, you want everyone to be doing well to make it a healthy industry, but you want to beat everyone else too.
Well, what's happened, you mentioned the comedy boom in the 80s. There was this great boom in the late 80s, early 90s. There were a lot of stand-up comedy venues in the city of Chicago. What's happened now is there's fewer stand-up venues, but there's more open mic stages. But what we do at Zany's, we try and differentiate ourselves. We are the only club in the country that headlines national comedians every night of the week.
Is that right? So every night there's going to be someone, a national name.
There's going to be a headliner, right. A national name, they've either done national television, they have some sort of national television credit. This isn't a showcase. This isn't an open mic. You'll never see an open mic at Zany's. It's always professional talent.
And I feel I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we pay our talent. People say, well, why do you charge a cover charge? Why do you have a two-item minimum? Well, we pay our talent. That's different.
So the open mic, right. The open mic, you've got the stage filled for free, basically, if you're running a club.
It's just that. They're new talents that are aspiring, and someday they may be on the Zany stage, and some of them will eventually become household names.
You know,
right now, they're new talents.
I feel a little guilty that you've closed your Vernon Hills location. I live in Deerfield. Yes. And I would hear about these names, and I never went. So if you look at what you've got open now, you've got Chicago, obviously, St. Charles at Pheasant Run, and then Rosemont in the entertainment complex there. So you do best in areas where people are going to be anyway.
Right, and you know, there was a plus and a minus to closing Vernon Hills. We hated to give up that club after 19 years, but the plus was we were able to open a newer, better room in Rosemont.
And Rosemont is where there's automatically a population in.
Well, we're part of the entertainment complex here, the Parkway Bank entertainment complex, so it's just a great location.
Okay, when anyone talks about a comedy club, they talk about the room upstairs or the green room or whatever it is. When I used to interview authors, I interviewed a lot of comedians. I interviewed Chelsea Handler once, and I don't have that comedian talking to sort of button. So I did this totally serious Chelsea Handler interview. She ended it and she said, I've never done a serious interview before. And I didn't quite get that. But the fact is, I notice, and it's not a secret, comedians are a different sort of people. I mean, you can say it about firemen maybe or cowboys or whatever, but comedians seem to be an individual breed. And if you're managing all these different comedians every day of the year, you must bring a skill set to the office, or how do you deal with all of that? And am I wrong? Are they not a little different?
Yeah, yes, they are different because they look at the world with a skewed perspective. But most comedians are not those joke-a-minute type comedians
right.
that you picture. Most of them are introverted and great observers. They observe the human interrelationships, and then they comment on those from an outsider's point of view. The skill set that I have is that my boss, the founder of Zanies, taught me the importance of relationships in this business. And that's really one of the reasons that Zanies has been able to stay in business for 40 years, is because we have comedians like Richard Lewis. Richard could easily sell out a much larger room than our little 140-seat club downtown. But Richard comes back to us after 40 years because of the relationship we've developed with him. Same thing with Marsha. Marsha really hasn't been doing much stand-up anywhere in the country. And when I asked her about coming back as part of our 40-year anniversary, she was like, oh, I'd be honored.
Yeah.
And so it's those relationships you develop over the years that helps you work with these people. And they're all great people. I can say I've worked with maybe 1,000, 5,000 comedians in my career. There's only one, maybe two, that I would say, boy, I never want to see that person again.
Excellent, Bert. Well, this is where you tell us who those people are.
and I'm going to continue to stay in the business, so I won't tell you who they are.
Listen, it was great to talk to you. I wish you continued success.
Thank you so much for your time.
All right, we'll do it again.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Oh, the number of the week this week is 36, as in 36%. Now, listen to this. The number of times a garment was worn before being thrown out dropped 36% between the years 2000 and 2015. It's a sign of fast fashion changing the way we buy our clothes. Also, the fact that new clothes are becoming much cheaper, the same as used clothes. So we are throwing out our clothes 36% more quickly, one way of looking at it, than we did just in the year 2000. And the problem there is that poor countries can get their own clothes now cheaply. They don't necessarily want the recycled stuff, and that could be landfill trouble. 36%. 12:54, you're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGNR. Let's go back to the days of Benjamin Franklin. Stirring the Pot with Benjamin Franklin, a founding father's culinary adventures. The author is Ray Catherine Amy, and she joins us on a phone line now. Ray, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
All right, so this is a business show. I'm interested in this topic, but I'm trying to figure out the business angle. But one of them might be that Franklin early on understood food policy in this country, and he made arguments in favor of recognizing that with the colonists, correct?
He did that, but he was also an astute businessman. He started work at age 12, being apprenticed to his printer brother. By the time he was 24, he had his own business, and within 18 years, he was able to retire, having made enough money, he thought, to be able to live the rest of his life.
I love the idea that you're telling the story of Benjamin Franklin through the food he ate. I'm going to have to ask you about the recipe for beef a la mode, too. But
okay.
What is it that we learn from someone by looking at what they ate or how they ate?
Well, that's a really good question, Stephen. What you can see from Franklin is, as you started out, he recognized the importance of particular American foods. When he was in London, he craved to have the taste of America sent to him, and his wife Deborah sent him cranberries, smoked venison, smoked hams, and apples that he particularly liked. But she also sent a lot of different kinds of corn. I was intrigued to hear the corn acreage in the farm report. Franklin would have been astounded. He recognized that maize was the essential American grain and used it as an argument in a series of editorials that he exchanged during the Stamp Act kerfuffle, suggesting that where the British were sort of denigrating American corn, they really didn't understand the value of corn and how beneficial it was and how healthy it was. And they kind of wimped out eating, you know, things like Yorkshire pudding. And if they couldn't understand the value of the essential American grain, they couldn't understand America.
How many founding fathers were vegetarian, at least for a time? Benjamin Franklin was?
He was. And you know, I really don't know the answer to that, except I know that Franklin was for a period in his youth. He did it for a couple of reasons. One, to be from the moral argument. The other was it was a good economic thing. He was working for his brother, and his brother said, well, you know, it's too much trouble for the cook who's feeding the rest of the apprentices to make special meals for you. So how about if I give you half of what I would pay her to make your meals, and then you can go buy what you want? Well, Ben, being waste not, want not, saw that was a great deal. He spent half of the money on food. He would eat tarts and bread and milk. And the other half he used to buy books.
And there you go.
There you go. And he also then had the hour where the others were off eating lunch as time to study.
Speaking of books.
I have to tell you. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. We're just about out of time, but tell me quickly.
Oh, I was just going to tell you, there's a business lunch where he kind of served up wheat bran pudding, which was just horrible, but he served it to make the point that he really didn't need patronage of others as he was setting up his own business. And if he could live on the sawdust pudding, as was called, in water, then he didn't need the patronage of anyone, and he was setting his standard for what he would be able to do in his business life and then onward to his political and founding father life.
I like the stories. I like the recipes. I don't think I'll try beef a la mode, but I will try asparagus and pea soup. So thanks for that.
That's a fabulous recipe, and you need to try the lemon ice cream. It goes together really, really fast, and it's just this great, refreshing combination of crystalline and cream.
Ray, Catherine, Amy, the name of the book, Stirring the Pot with Benjamin Franklin. Nice to talk to you, Ray. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.